The Ocelli Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck Ocelli.
January 5, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. So, anyway, it's Wednesday night, and unfortunately for those that are normally tuned into the network, there was no Donald Jeffries show leading up to this show, but that's all right. We'll get you through the night anyway. John Potash is going to be with us in, maybe about 20 minutes. We shall soon see. But for the meantime, I have my Wednesday producer with me, Nature Boy. You know him well. And John is going to come on in about 20 minutes or less now to talk about Tupac Shakur and his new version of a book that I think he might have put out in 2007 initially, but it's been revised, new material added, etc. I think it's with a different publisher. I mean, there's a bunch of things going on here, but the Wednesday producer is with us first, so let's talk to him about that. Oh, and there might be something else that John wants to talk to us about in the, hour and 40, hour and 30, however much time we get with him tonight. So, Nature Boy, first off, man, how you doing this Wednesday?
I'm doing okay, just trying to survive in the crazy state of California, you know.
California. Do we need a California update? I mean, it can't be like Philly where they had the massive fire today. It can't be much crazier than, well, normal because it's California. So what is normal? But how's things, brother? I mean, really, is it really a crazy state or yeah. Are you just fed up?
Well, both. But everybody's just losing their collective. You know what? Over this Omicron thing. And an example is right down the street from me, there's a church that every Tuesday they have free testing. Generally, okay. For the longest, there really hasn't been a line, at least outside the door or anything. It's been pretty empty. And when there is, it's pretty short, even when I went down there a long, long time ago. So yesterday I had to run some errands and I drove by it, Chuck, and I'm not exaggerating. It was not only out the door, it was completely wrapped around almost the entire building. It went out to the street, along the street, and all the way to the back of the parking lot. And the capper is this was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at closing time. So that means that's probably been the line the entire day.
Well, it's like they're giving away $20 iPhones on Black Friday over there. I mean, really, what are we talking about? Of course, whenever they do that and the line wraps around the building, there's only like 5 phones available. But anyway, so get your rapid test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody's just going crazy over essentially a bad cold, at least according to the doctor that discovered the variant in South Africa, who says, yes, it's extremely transmissible, but it's very mild. It's akin to a bad cold. And yet, everybody is just freaking out. I mean, look across the states, New York. Oh, this is just another reason to bring down more draconian lockdowns and this and that for a cold.
So, I don't know. It's... You know what I think at this point, and I got to make the most declarative statement about this possible. I think they don't know that you need to do anything. I think that is it something bad, worse, whatever? We're not going to be able to collect that data properly because nobody's keeping it properly. So it's a crapshoot as far as I'm concerned. I'm seeing varied results from people all over the place. I mean – for the second time, somebody who had been a regular guest on this show has now gotten the Rona, right? And it's a guy who his whole house at one point was quarantined because they were in the midst of the intense part of the lockdowns during that time period when it happened. I'm not going to identify him because I'm actually thinking about having him back on the show, but apparently he's good and sick again, and they're telling him that's exactly what's doing it. I don't know if that's true or if it's partially true or, you know, because as I said and got, hit for on different platforms, frankly, if you look at scientific data that was available previous to this particular alleged pandemic, guess what? Coronavirus has accounted for about half of what the common cold was already. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, Chuck, that's the novel coronavirus. How dare you? I know. But I'm just saying what I was able to read. And then it's just, I don't know, man. I've got like corona exhaustion here. What are we going to do? Are we going to lock down? Are we going to fight? Are we going to have masks? Are we going to have, everybody needs to get 1, 2, 3, 4, how many shots? I mean, where does this end? Which is funny, because not only are we going to talk to Potash in a little while, and I keep screwing up his name. I think it's Potash anyway.
Or Potash. Or Potash.
Potash?
John Potash. I'm not sure. I mean, I didn't think he... I think he was quite happy with how you originally pronounced his name the last time he was on, so...
Potash. Either way, let me tell you something. He's a great author.
Very.
Drugs as Weapons Against Us... A key great book, period. Full stop. Excellent book. And we're not talking about that today necessarily. But I am looking forward to talking to him about Tupac. Tupac's an interesting character for a lot of reasons. You got your pop culture significance. You also have the fact that I don't know if anybody knows this out there, because who knows? I don't think we got a lot of college students right now that listen to the show. But if you were a college student and you were in a HBC, a historically black college, Tupac's entered into your poetry classes. You know, I know that factually. And he actually wrote some really good stuff. I mean, forget about the sound, which, by the way, there's some interesting sound, well-produced stuff, in my opinion, by Shakur. There's interesting messaging. There's some vulgarity in there for sure. But it is, decisively philosophical, and he's definitely a wordsmith, or, well, I should say was.
Yeah.
You know, and the speculation over whether he was murdered or targeted or what exactly, you know, here's the thing. Celebrities often being targeted or utilized or weaponized or whacked one way or another. This is something we're all familiar with. Mm-hmm. Acts, something that the government does, something that the powers that should not be do. Sure. And some people would say, well, this guy was, you know what, involved in a thug life and all this kind of stuff. And, okay, let's just say that was true, although, frankly, it wasn't.
No, he wasn't a gangbanger whatsoever. He was an artist. And what he did is he reflected the times and the things that he saw around him.
Well, his parents were Black Panthers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's problem number one.
Mm-hmm.
And the Black Panthers, you know, they wish to neutralize, and that's the word they used during the time of COINTELPRO. They wish to neutralize these gentlemen all the way across the board, and people talk about it all the time and say, you know, well, I got to tell you, I'm totally sick of the sentence. Well, you know, the Ku Klux Klan, like the Black Panthers.
No, you can't really compare the two.
No, a community organizer that is attempting to what? Promote self-defense and, oh, by the way, fully in support of the Second Amendment, and didn't want the police to abuse people in their community. Mm-hmm. Not quite the same as
put a cross on somebody's front yard, light it up, and then string them up if they say anything, which is what the Ku Klux Klan did.
Well, there's that. And then there's FBI files. I mean, Larry Pinkney used to come on this show, and he was one of the original Black Panthers. And, you know, when he finally got out of prison after successfully getting the United Nations to hear his case as a political prisoner in Canada, of all places, you know, one of the things that came forward in his FBI file is that they wished to neutralize Mr. Pinkney. Mm-hmm. And they wished to neutralize a lot of these guys. Why was Larry Pinkney dangerous in particular?
Oh, I could answer that, because he united races that were in the prison systems that the system intentionally kept separated and at war. And he had this unique ability to cross those racial barriers and started bringing these people together. And then once, like so much of the time, when you actually start to get to know somebody else that you might have a fear trip over, you find out that you actually have a lot in common. And he started uniting them. And then the prison system, well, we can't have any of that. And they shipped him off. I think they even put him in solitary a few times for
stuff, yeah.
Bringing people together.
No. Pinckney's story is deep, but here's the thing, and no disrespect to him. I don't know why he hasn't come back on the show, but I love this guy. But the thing is, there was others. And what were they doing? They went to disparate other groups and started teaching, like, the it was a forerunner of, like, say, the Vice Lords, except it was the Latino gang guys. They pulled them together and said, look, why don't you learn how to organize like Panthers do? And they created an organization. And there were others in places like Chicago, believe it or not, where they were pulling together. Look, you know what? You got your group together. It is ethnically decided what your group is because of your neighborhood, your community. How about if we all work together? And they even went to, like, redneck type dudes and were like, look, no, keep your white pride. Let's all stand in defiance of those that would seek to weaponize us against one another.
Mm-hmm.
Let us, you know, and I'm not even saying that I necessarily agree with that, but it is a whole lot more sensible than being pitted against one another, than having, you know, things done like what was done at that time, where there was literally propaganda printed up and turning, putting stuff that would be divisive, inflammatory, in the hands of the black community about the neighboring white community and vice versa. They would do this all the time to get these groups that were, well, a little bit jacked up and angry about the fact that they felt like they were being dominated by something or other. They would turn them against each other constantly. And guys like Hampton and Pinckney and a few others in the Black Panther movement said, look, we just want to defend our people and our communities. We think you all should do the same if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention the fact that they had breakfast programs and other things, other, you know, grassroots organized programs of uplift. I'm sorry, I've never seen the Klan do that. Maybe they do. Maybe they do, and I don't know about it. But quite honestly, it drives me crazy that especially when people go, oh, they were violent. Their violence, their violent reputation generally stems from the fact that they walked into the California State Capitol with guns on them.
Mm-hmm. Fully armed and just stood there.
Fully armed. Didn't fire shots or anything, but here's the thing. One, it was not illegal to do so at the time.
It was their legal right, and they were exercising their Second Amendment rights.
They were doing that.
Yes.
And so this is the thing that, became the terrifying image. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that everybody was a saint who put on a black beret, okay? I would never say that about any group of people. You're never going to find purity in behavior among, well, people. I mean, so, you know, it's going to happen. There are things going on here. But the reason why I'm talking about this is because Tupac's life begins among what? The New York Black Panthers. And, you know, there's a whole story about his mother, and she's supposedly a cop killer, and lot of stuff here. I'm not saying it's all clean and pretty and pristine. What I am saying is that there's plenty of reason for this guy to already be in the crosshairs of, well, let's just call them agencies that don't necessarily play fair or clean, even though they're supposed to be law enforcement. So I'm wondering if Potash is going to talk about that. I suspect he will.
Well, considering it's the FBI's war against Tupac Shakur, something like that. I have to actually read the thing. Yeah, I think that might come into play. And he might even discuss a little bit of this thing called COINTELPRO.
Mm, he might have to.
Yeah.
Another thing just to mention here really quickly is that you know how old Shakur would be today if he were still alive, which, by the way, there are people that are still doing the, you know, maybe he's still alive because they kept releasing his music and all that.
He's smoking out with Elvis down in Tahiti.
Hey, listen, if they are, I would love to be there and see what that conversation sounds like, because it would be something. Elvis, not exactly a racist dude, from my understanding. And I think I think he might be all right with kicking back with Tupac. I don't know. I don't know, but who knows? Who knows at this point? But Tupac would be the same age as me, just about. I think a little older. He'd be 50 years old in 2021 sometime.
Yeah, a little bit younger than me and a little bit older than you.
Yeah, so we're not even talking about a guy who, you know, would have been dead a long time. And again, there's the whole Biggie Smalls thing that comes along with this. And, you know, true enough, there was the West Coast, East Coast deal. And when you take a look at the people from Death Row Records, which some people are even afraid to comment on, Suge Knight, the gangster, maybe his wife's a gangster, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, missing from that is the huge startup money that Suge Knight got. And the fact that Death Row Records, what did they employ? A whole bunch.
Like a cops or something.
LAPD. You know, and I got to tell you, it's going to be interesting to hear about the, this is something I got to ask him about because I know it's in the book. Literally police units being organized in order to do what? Target rappers. And I know for sure other musicians have been targets, you know, throughout, I don't know, the 20th century. Of various policing agencies. I mean, they purposely went after people like, you know, Ray Charles and Chuck Berry. I mean, they wanted to make sure they got them. And I think that was a natural sort of racist backlash from the culture shock, maybe. But other things have gone on here where we found that the FBI, the CIA, the policing agencies all over the country get awfully interested in musicians sometimes. And why? Because I think they can actually affect massive amounts of individuals. But another thing that John's going to want to talk about, we actually have a trailer here, and I think we're just going to sit back here and take a listen to this trailer for a minute. Might be actually three if you're counting at home. But take a listen to this trailer. Now, I'm not sure exactly how John's involved in this, but he made it a point that he wanted to devote some of the discussion to this. So we'll find out if it'll be at the beginning or the end of the discussion with John. But I'm just going to go ahead and play the trailer. Nature Boy's with me, by the way. It is Wednesday. This is not a commercial break as of yet. But we're going to just take a listen to this interesting trailer.
By 1912, the WASP super wealthy families, America's oligarchs, including railroad tycoon E.H. Harriman, the Rockefellers, and Morgans, had joined the Carnegies in sponsoring eugenics nationwide. In state hospitals, they fed the feebles milk from tuberculosis-infected cows to get rid of them. The oligarchs overflowed with creative ways to kill. The eugenics office workers were even merrier than Mary Harriman. With over 35,000 sterilizations and castrations lined up, they just had to sing. Anthony Sutton titled the third chapter of his book, General Electric Funds Hitler, due to German General Electric sharing directors with IG Farben, Tyson, and other German companies, as well as funding 40% of the Nazis' electrical production. NBC News covered how some states kept practicing eugenics as late as the 1970s.
31 states had legal eugenics programs.
Pharmaceutical giant vaccine makers, Bristol-Myers and Merck, interlocked with the New York Times and Time Incorporated, respectively.
Today, that 90% of media is now owned and controlled by six giant media conglomerates, General Electric, News Corp, Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, and CBS.
The ABC News article cited CDC findings that 94% of the reported COVID-19 deaths involved an average of 2.6 other potential causes of death. As the narrator of this documentary on Bill Gates revealed, he was also the top donor to the Center for Disease Control, CDC. This Brookings Institution article shows CDC stats that report how middle-aged Black and Latino death rates are at least six times higher than for whites.
Some people might wear them for days, in which case you might get the bacteria might grow inside the mask. All of those are opportunities to actually get yourself sick.
PCR is separate from that. It's just a process that's used to make a whole lot of something out of something. That's what
also,
it is. It doesn't tell you that you're sick, and it doesn't tell you that the thing you ended up with really was going to hurt you or anything like that.
My Adams, the Moderna vaccine, Tony Fauci's top aides own royalties to that. So people in his agency collect $150,000 a year in royalties on that vaccine.
Pfizer, a name you can't trust, said the U.S. Justice Department in 2009.
The federal government today announced the largest medical fraud settlement in U.S. history.
Mountains of data have emerged from many centers and countries around the world showing the miraculous effectiveness of ivermectin. It basically obliterates transmission of this virus. If you take it, you will not get sick.
To give some context, over the past 20 years, all vaccinations combined, there were a reported 4,182 deaths over the past 20 years. In the past 4 months, we're now sitting at 4,178 deaths associated with the COVID vaccine. With a study commissioned by the Department of Health and Human Services, this is in 2010, and Harvard carried out this study. And the conclusion was only about 1% of adverse reactions are ever reported to VAERS.
You are injecting a bioweapon into the arms of our children and the people we love.
And the overlords decide which ones deserve to live, which ones deserve to die. Time to leave.
Well, that's a hell of a trailer, I'll tell you that much. Let's see. Where are we going to get banned first? That's going to happen. I doubt YouTube is going to carry this one unless we make an edit without the trailer in it, honestly, Nature Boy.
I can do that, but, you know, I just assume to let it rip because I'm tired of the mass censorship that's going on from everywhere. Everywhere, it seems like, except for some smaller platforms.
I know it, but is it better to remain on some of these platforms or not? That's always the question. Mm-hmm. I don't know. The hell with it. We'll run with it as is. I am looking forward to this already. I've got a couple people in the chat room, I guess, are going to tune out because they don't care about the topic of Tupac Shakur. I don't know, man. I don't know what that means exactly, but I do. This is fascinating. Look, if you just accept that a guy is an artist, has a fascinating background, maybe is a little bit dangerous to the establishment or the federal government, or, you know, because they're not necessarily the same thing, but, and somebody decided to assassinate the guy, where does that leave people who make statements? You know, I mean, is it just okay because you don't like them? Is that okay to just kill people because they're putting out art you're not pleased with? I don't know. I always thought of the don't buy it, don't listen to it, don't turn it on, and you'll be fine. The art can't hurt you. But, right.
Well,
okay.
It depends on who you are. If you're the establishment, the power centers, and you have somebody out there who is reaching millions upon millions of people with a message that goes contrary to your interests, then yeah, you're the one that you don't want the other people to listen to.
Not fair enough. And look, the trailer, by the way, that we played is called Shots. Okay, ready for this? Shots, Eugenics to Pandemics. And I think is going to make some interesting arguments. And, gee, it'll be fascinating to hear how that goes. I also heard Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in there. So I don't know what part he plays in said documentary or movie or whatever. There was, you know, a lot of interesting stuff that I saw in a movie that I got a hold of the other day, which is called the Pizzagate Massacre. Might as well hit all the stops tonight. I got to say, I was impressed by the satirical look of the thing. Let's go to a break, though, because I think we'll be able to bring John Potash in just a few minutes here. So stick around. The Ocelli Effect will continue. Nature Boy, you might drop off here, but I do know that we'll have John with us shortly. And no offense or anything, but I'm anxiously awaiting talking to him. So,
am I.
Anyway, we'll get to it in a couple of minutes. Stick around, guys. We won't go to the normal commercial breaks, but something's about to happen for the rest of this hour and a half plus on the Ocelli Effect Wednesday. Stick around.
Ochilly.com.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
Exhumed from the ashes, reborn chaotically.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to The Ochilly Effect at Ochilly.com.
We should learn from our relatively recent history, my brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say all power to the people.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media. Chuck
O'Shelley. So here we are after a quick break, and we did the introduction and also played a trailer for... God knows I'm going to get dinged for this. But anyway, shots, eugenics to pandemics. And I'm not sure exactly what that is about as far as John Potesh's connection to it, but we'll get there. As I stated in the initial discussion, Tupac Shakur is the main focus. But do you want to start with this trailer? Because we played the audio.
I would like to start with the trailer. So... yeah, I'll get back to that story about RFK and Tupac later, you know, when I talk about Tupac at length. But the trailer is really important to me because I've been working the whole past year on a new documentary film that I backed into. I didn't even mean for the film to be about that until it all hit, and it was just supposed to be the very end of my film. And I found out so much stuff that implicated the billionaire class and the – what I call the biosecurity state in bringing us into this, you know, crazy pandemic right now. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, instituting martial law against us, you know, in parts of the world coming to here now too, with the division of people between the vaccinated, the unvaccinated and all that crap. And so I just got offered a platform to show it on, and we'll see how soon we can get it up on that platform. But, I'm just really happy about that. It's called Peeps TV. So, you know, hopefully it's going to be there very soon, maybe within the next week or two if I'm lucky, but, you know, maybe a little after that, I'm not sure. But I also got offered a distribution deal, and but that would take 3 to 6 months to get it on all, you know, on other platforms. So I'm just very happy about, you know, the fact that, the movie's been done, got the distribution, you know, like probably lined up. We just have to, you know, sign the contract that was sent to me. But also a platform that might get it out within the next week or two if I'm, you know, hopefully, you know, I've been offered it. So we'll see. Hopefully it'll all come through. And I just think it's incredibly, you know, important to realize that the tactics they're using now, the billionaire class, you know, the oligarchs of the billionaire class, not all the billionaires, but the oligarchs. And granted, you know, an article just came out today in Global Research, if you've seen that, you know, forum, where they just cited a Wall Street Journal article and showed the Wall Street Journal article that said in 2009, a billionaires club met, you know, Bill Gates and the rest of them, and decided that they needed to have depopulation. I mean, believe it or not, the Wall Street Journal even put this in their headline. They decided we needed depopulation. And it's playing out now. Now, Bill Gates even said it in a YouTube video, and I have him saying it in my film, you know, and from 2010, just after that 2009 meeting. But it's so clear with Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s excellent new book, which I did a book review for, and hopefully that's going to be coming out with in Covert Action Magazine within the next few days, because they're putting it in. They're just copying it now. But RFK Jr.'s book just basically lays out with 1,000 endnotes how this biosecurity state developed. You know, it focuses, it's called The Real Anthony Fauci, and it's a bestseller on Amazon. It was on the New York Times bestseller list. It was on all the bestseller lists for a long time. It's still a number one seller, you know, top two, three, you know, constantly on Amazon, going back and forth between one, two, and three, whatever. And it just lays out how Fauci was a key person to spearhead this and front the big pharma, you know, industry that's intimately tied with the military intelligence and the billionaire class in really, I can say, is committing genocide, first with AZT and with the AIDS scare and, you know, and basically misdiagnosing what was really going on, but putting forth this drug that killed people. AZT killed people, tons of people. And it's just like remdesivir, which they say was the only one of two drugs approved for all the hospitals to use for this pandemic now. And remdesivir killed people. Remdesivir, you know, in one experiment killed over 50% of the control group taking remdesivir that was tried, and they tried it against Ebola. And so, you know, they also showed that the ventilators, which was, you know, said to be the best use, the you know, best way to help a lot of people that were having panic attacks, 88% of people that went on respirators were killed. Ventilators, I mean, you know, were killed, died from those ventilators. Now, you can say, oh, well, they would have died anyway, but not really. I mean, they shouldn't have been put on ventilators if 88% of them were going to die. They should have been given oxygen. And there was other methods, you know, to treat them. And there's loads of other methods to treat these patients that, you know, end up being hospitalized and sick. There's ivermectin, which loads of studies around the world to show has been excellent for treatment. You know, and then there's hydroxychloroquine, which is with zinc and azithromycin together, all three together, has been excellent for this, you know, COVID-19. And yet they purposely, you know, tried to, you know, demonize these medications the same way there was loads of medications that helped, you know, AIDS patients. And they demonized them, and then you have that movie, The Dallas Buyers Club, which is a true story, because people had to go to Mexico to get the proper medications for AIDS. And so this is the way they've done things for the last, you know, four or five decades. And so, you know, this is what we're in. This is where we're at. And now RFK Jr. did that book. I cover some of what's in RFK Jr.'s book in my film, but I go back all the way to the early 1900s, which RFK Jr. touches on. But I go into more a little more in depth with the way things happen with eugenics, and but I focus most of the film on the pandemic today, and with loads of people that RFK Jr. uses his experts too in his book, like Dr. Peter McCullough, Meryl Nass, Dr. Sukrit Bhakti, and some of these doctors, of course, advised him on this book, and I'm really happy to say one of these doctors actually copy edited, you know, reviewed my book review of RFK Jr.'s book to make sure I got everything right. So it's just, I'm really excited to get this, you know, these ideas out there. And in a comic way, it's a semi-comic film. I got loads of parodies, like commercial parodies for these companies that are warmongering companies like General Electric and all that. And so it's funny. I like to think it's funny throughout the way. My friends thought it was funny when they saw previews of it all. So, you know, hopefully everyone thinks it's funny too.
Well, I think the only way to approach subjects like this at this point is dark humor, because you know, I give up anymore trying to beat people over the head with facts.
Right.
You know, and RFK Jr., it's been an interesting journey there for him. You know, this book is remarkable in that it's still up on the bestseller list.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't strike it, to be honest with you. I mean, Bezos is literally somebody you could implicate here, and yet it's on the Amazon bestsellers list.
Yeah.
You know, and a fascinating thing is that James Corbett, you know, since you mentioned Global Research,
sure.
I remember he was part of that. I don't know if he still is, honestly. Yeah. I'm, of course. But he did a good interview with Bobby Kennedy Jr. not long ago about this exact topic. And frankly, here's the thing we need to know, though. I'm going to put the link to the trailer, which is on Vimeo, along with the show notes tonight. But we don't know where this movie will be available when it is. So where is it people can go, though, to keep up in case they want to find out? I mean, did you create a social media account for the movie yet, or do they have to go to your website or what?
Well, yeah, they got to go to my website right now, shotsmovie.com. It's called Shots, Eugenics, the Pandemics, and you can go to shotsmovie.com, which is at the end of the trailer, too, because okay. I just renamed my website that also. But I'll say, you know, it should. I did get the official offer in writing, so it should be on Peeps TV within soon. I'm guessing within the next weeks or month at most, I'm guessing. I mean, hopefully we're going to finalize everything. But, you know, I did get the offer, and the only thing is I got the offer after I got an offer for, full North American rights distribution from another company. I didn't sign that contract yet. So, as of now, it should be fine for it to be on Peeps TV very soon. And,
Well, either way, they can go to shotsmovie.com, right?
I'll put the information up on there for how to find Peeps TV, which is on the Roku channel. It's
right.
Free on the Roku channel, yeah.
No, but either way, I mean, look, if they can get the free Roku channel, all the better. If they got to go and pay a couple of bucks to go see it somewhere, that's fine, too. I mean, whatever it takes, let's get this kind of stuff out there.
Yeah,
it needs to be done, man.
Thanks. Yeah, it's going to be about $5, like $4.99 to rent, on the Peeps TV channel, just because, when you put a lot of money into these things, it's hard to, you got to rent, you got to have people pay a little bit of money for it to get something back and not lose your shirt on it. And so, I'm trying not to lose so much on it and trying to gain a little bit back, of course.
Yeah, well, tell me about it. Look, I know you know all about not making money when it comes to writing books. I mean, because, and no offense to you, it's just that's the business at this point. You're not making
money. It really is. It really is.
So,
yeah, my first version of the Tupac book, actually, I self-published. And that, of course, was my most money-making project, except the fact that my Drugs as Weapons film is finally turning a profit, which is nice, but it took a while. It took, 2 years now, 2.5 years, 3 years. But it's really hard, right, to turn a profit if you don't, if it's not coming directly to you. We know that, so.
Right. And look, the landscape keeps shifting, too, so it's difficult to do. And look, I think that when the film is actually distributed and I get a chance to watch the whole thing, we'll probably have to have another conversation if you're good with that, because
I'd love to. It's so great to talk to someone on the same page. We're so isolated out here, sure you've got friends and family like myself. That make us feel like lepers, That's what's the world today.
I got a whole story I could tell you that really irritates the hell out of me, that somebody that I've been waiting 40 years to meet, I can't go meet now, And it's just like, that's not going to make me bend the knee or roll up my sleeve anyway. Okay. Right. It's just not going to happen. But, nonetheless, nobody can respect your personal choices, even if that's all you want to say about it. But anyway, let's move forward here, because this is what I want to talk to you about today. And I started talking to Nature Boy about it in like a very small segment before we could get you on, because, the story of Tupac Shakur is interesting because people react to it in a lot of different ways. And I'm not going to make any bones about it. I mean, I definitely was when his death occurred, I was certainly sucked into the whole narrative about, well, it's the East Coast versus the West Coast. And, and then Biggie Smalls. And I went through all that and I found it kind of baseless, honestly, despite the fact that, people are still making documentaries on that premise. Tupac is somebody who is now in death, as I stated during the piece with Nature Boy, is studied in poetry classes and in literary classes. A lot of his work, it goes well beyond just, some profanity and a little bit of, let's call it bravado from the, gangsta rap style of the time, etc. He had a lot more to say. And when people are willing to utilize their art to provoke thought that could be radical, that'll buck the system, this is a problem in and of itself. And I do believe that there are famous people that, you know, they get the choice handed to them. They're either weaponized or they're whacked. Mm-hmm. And whether it's implicitly told to them or not, that's just the way of things. I think that that's a possibility, but Tupac goes deeper. And why? Because this story starts in New York. This story starts in, well, among the Black Panthers of New York.
Yeah, and further back than that even. Yeah, but definitely, no doubt. But
that's where I begin to come into it because, as I stated also during that time, I was talking about the misrepresentation and still the continued demonization of the Black Panthers. I don't know if you recognize it, but when I come back from the break there, that's Larry Pinkney who says all power to the people during my clip there because he used to be on the show. He was a Black Panther.
Yeah.
One of the individuals who got a hold of his own FBI file with the word neutralize in it.
Yeah.
You know, and why? Because it wasn't about, you know, Black power to the point of we need to compare you to the Klan, which is what a lot of people do.
And that's a shame. Yeah, that's a misunderstanding.
And so begin there. But let's go to New York and talk about, well, Tupac's childhood, for starters. But maybe you want to take it further back.
Yeah, I do want to take it further back because one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is because I realized in researching this for many, many years, I started researching this subject in general. And about 1990, when I was working in Baltimore City, you know, I think I told you this last time, as an addictions counselor, and this, you know, client of mine, we call him, you know, said my father was a Black Panther killed by the police. I was researching the Black Panthers. I found that the Shakurs were the leading Black Panthers of New York, you know, of the Bronx and Manhattan and Harlem and all. And so the Shakur family, I found, offers a window into like an unknown underground kind of look at the great Black liberation movement, you know, for just helping free, you know, for the civil rights, like an alternative view of the civil rights era. And I say that because Saeedean Abba Shakur was an amazing man. He was close with Marcus Garvey of the United Negro Improvement Association, which was a million strong on the East Coast alone, when he founded that group. And so, and he was hounded by U.S. intelligence all the way back then. Malcolm X's father was part of Marcus Garvey's group. And so Malcolm X was inspired by that. Malcolm X's father, of course, was assassinated. And then Malcolm X grows up and becomes, you know, the leader he became. And he was an incredible man because of the evolution he made, you know, to first being, you know, kind of separating himself from whites and then accepting whites as his comrades when he separated from the Nation of Islam and formed the Afro-American Unity Group, you know. It was called the Organization for African-American Unity, and that was based on an African group of leaders that called themselves the Organization for African Unity. And they were Malcolm X was the only Black leader they accepted in their meetings in Africa. And so Saeedean Abba Shakur was a close confidant of Malcolm X's before he died. And then Saeedean raised his biological sons, Lumumba Shakur and Zaid Shakur. They became part of Malcolm X's group, as did, I believe, Sekou Odinga, a close friend of Lumumba Shakur's. And then when Malcolm X was assassinated and it came, you know, to about 1967, 68, when the Black Panthers had formed in Oakland, California, when they came to New York, they immediately made Lumumba Shakur head of the Harlem Black Panthers and Zaid Shakur, the Minister of Information for the Bronx Black Panthers, and Sekou Odinga, the head of the Bronx Black Panthers, because they recognized these were the leaders of the Black community in New York. Now, most people don't know about that because it's erased history. And so here was the Shakurs leading, you know, the leaders of the Panthers in that area. And so that was So Tupac's mother, Fania Shakur, rises up in the Black Panthers in Harlem, and Lumumba Shakur marries her. And now, when they were attacked by the Black Panthers, by the New York Police Intelligence Unit, the same guy that was the first to rush to Malcolm X's body, a guy named Eugene Roberts, had infiltrated Malcolm's group, became head of security, and then ran to his body and made sure that the assassination was successful. Okay, and so what happened in Martin Luther King's assassination? The first person to arrive at Martin Luther King's body made sure the assassination was successful, according to William Pepper, one of the best, investigators of Martin Luther King's assassination. He was a friend of Martin Luther King's before he died. And so Pepper said it was to, check out his life signs. And Merrill McCollough was a military intelligence agent who, after Martin Luther King's assassinations, promoted to the CIA. So you get the parallels there. And then Gene Roberts, what's he do after, Malcolm X's assassination? He then infiltrates the Black Panthers in New York City and then stands up in trial and says, I was an undercover agent with the police intelligence unit. And they were trying to blow up, places in New York and all that, and so they should go to jail. But they got off. Fannie Shakur represented herself in court as her own lawyer, and she was credited with helping get them all off, all the Black Panther 21 leaders off who were on trial there. And then Fannie Shakur, while she's defending herself, in that trial in 1971, she's pregnant with Tupac Shakur. And so, it's wild how that's where his story starts, is in court, Fannie Shakur is defending herself against a frame-up with Eugene Roberts, trying to, put her in jail and all the other police undercover agents. And so Tupac's born to a Fannie. She's a national, media star because of what she did, defending herself in court and being successful. She hadn't gone to college yet. She was very young. She was only about 20 at the time. And she was in jail from the time she was 19, because that was the longest trial in New York City history. And here she is. She calls Tupac at his birth. She calls Tupac her Black Prince of the Revolution. And that's the environment he grew up in. And so Lumumba had divorced her while they were in prison, because when she was elected to be out of prison and be a spokesperson for the group, and because of the free love of the 60s, she ended up sleeping with a New Jersey Black Panther, and that was Tupac's biological father. But they still stayed actually close despite the divorce. They published chapters in a book together, and then Fannie ended up moving in with Lumumba's adopted brother, Mutulu Shakur. Saidi and Abba Shakur adopted some other kids and tried to raise them into activists too. And Mutulu became an excellent activist. He was part of the Republic of New Africa. He was trained in acupuncture and started Lincoln Detox in the Bronx. And so that was Tupac's stepfather. And Tupac loved him. Tupac used to help, go to the Lincoln Detox, which was an incredible revolutionary acupuncture clinic for addictions. I got trained there because it lasted till at least 2007 when I was living near the Bronx and went and trained there. And of course they framed Mutulu Shakur, and he's in prison the rest of his life. He was supposed to be let out on bail in 2016, and they wouldn't let him out. I mean, not let on bail, let out on parole. He was supposed to be paroled in 2016, but they wouldn't let him out because he wouldn't renounce his politics. But nonetheless, that was the start of Tupac's life. And by the time he was 13, Reverend Daultrey, Herbert Daultrey, said, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And he said, "Revolutionary," because that's all he knew. He was raised by revolutionaries, and that's the way he knew. And I don't mean the revolution and kill all the white people and take over. I mean revolution in the sense of get more rights for all the underclass people. And that was his philosophy, is to just change things for the better for everyone. And that was the Panthers' philosophy. That's why the Panthers teamed up with the Students for Democratic Society. We're trying to stop the war. And we're teamed up, Fred Hampton formed that first Rainbow Coalition. If you saw that film on Fred Hampton, how the FBI's counterintelligence program targeted him for neutralization and assassinated him. But, you know, he formed a lot of whites and Latinos and blacks all together to try to change society for the better for the 99%. So that's where it all starts, you know.
Well, no, absolutely. And, you know, I noted that effectively, I mean, I'm just a little bit younger than Tupac would be right now because I was born in 72. I think he was born in 72, but maybe a little earlier than me.
Yeah, he was born in 71 and I was born in 65. So I got a little jump on him. So I wasn't somebody living in Baltimore. I wrestled with some guys who turned me on to rap in high school. Wrestled with some city guys, black city guys who just turned me on to Grandmaster Flash and all the early New York stuff. And so I didn't know that much about it, but I was just, you know, I knew enough to like appreciate him at a pretty, you know, young age.
Right. Well, a film sometime in this recent, you know, pandemic blur, what was it? Judas and the Black Messiah, I think, yeah. Showed you that, that whole thing about infiltration and a paid off informant and what actually happened to that informant. But infiltration and control and leverage of these groups was not restricted to just the Black Panthers. It was standard operating procedure.
Yeah.
You mentioned Merrill McCullough. Well, another piece of his history is he was attached to something called the Invaders, which was a lesser known activist group, the same way. There were dozens of these groups all over the country that were of a fair size. I mean, we're not talking about small ones, lots of small activist groups everywhere, but, there were some large ones. The Invaders were a fairly large one, in Memphis. I know that, McCullough though, like you said, with King's assassination, that's the guy you see go to his body. In the famous photographs, even though Jesse Jackson later on claimed that he had cradled King's head and all that, which photographic evidence doesn't back him up. But anyway, you know, and there's a whole thing that goes along with that where the infiltration of, well, every kind of group. I mean, here's where we can mention the Klan. They were infiltrated by the FBI. And quite frankly, we're still not allowed to know the positions that some of the FBI agents held in the Klan. And, you know, just saying, there's stuff that's never.
So I cover that in my book because it's very interesting that one of those infiltrators claimed to be at virtually every, you know, horrible thing, incident that, you know, the Klan of his area were involved in. And yet he did nothing to stop any of them. And so, you know, it just shows that, you know, was he there to infiltrate and stop, or was he there to infiltrate and help coordinate, you know? Because if he didn't stop any of them, that goes against, you know, the law. You're not supposed to be allowed to watch all these horrific incidents and all these murders and all these, you know, vandalisms and arsons and everything else and just keep it going, you know? And that's what, but it's what he actually did. He is let it happen and kept going with it. And so, yeah, you know, that's a big question there.
Well, and this is not something you decided to write about, by the by, just, you know, this year or a couple of years ago, because checking into a few things, I realized that you were writing about this in the mid-90s for some publications. Yeah. And I don't know how much attention it got back then. I'm almost thinking it might have gotten more attention back then because the story was a little bit hotter, you know. Right. And this was about the targeting of Tupac Shakur. Now, I want to be fair about this all the way around. And I got to tell you that repeatedly what I find is that entertainers of all sorts – are targeted and I don't know if I said this to you or if I said this to Nature Boy now, but it's just they either get weaponized or whacked, a lot of them.
Yeah, no, I agree with that totally. And so I definitely agree with that. But with Tupac, it was interesting because you have, you know, the counterintelligence program, and granted, it was brutal against, you know, it targeted a lot of different people of all races, COINTELPRO. But we have so much documentation about how brutally it targeted the Black Panthers. And so I have in my book, I have a COINTELPRO agent who who says he found out that they continued the COINTELPRO after they supposedly officially closed in 1971, and they continued it at least into the mid-1990s. And so that's particularly important because Tupac, by the time he was 17 years old, he was elected as head of the New African Panthers, who were trying to replicate the Black Panthers, and they were active in 8 to 10 cities. So Tupac was already a national black leader before he became a rapper. So it's obvious that COINTELPRO, the latter-day COINTELPRO that this undercover agent talks about, would have targeted him. So there's the best evidence that the COINTELPRO under a different name would have targeted Tupac. And so I show all the evidence that yes, this is what happened, and they did it the same way they targeted his Black Panther, you know, parents and family. And that's why there was, about 6 to 7 different assassination attempts with evidence of that. And I show in my book by U.S. intelligence or police intelligence.
Right. So, okay. Now this is going to get into a weird area because this is, again, the more accessible mainstream kind of stuff. But I'd like you to answer for it anyway.
Sure.
Because I think it's useful to bring up. You can't mention Tupac without mentioning Chris Wallace, Biggie Smalls, or, the notorious B.I.G. All right. What's interesting here is that Tupac is often painted as a gangster. Now, before you answer to that, here's the thing about Chris. And Chris was, again, the notorious B.I.G., Biggie Smalls, Chris Wallace. Okay. He actually was a drug dealer.
Yeah, he was. Small level, weed dealer, sure.
No, I'm not saying that he was a big time, he wasn't a cartel head. But what I'm saying is that he had a little bit of street credit as a criminal.
He did, no doubt, yeah. Low level, but sure.
No, low level. And, of course, it was kind of fashionable to amp that up a little bit. And some people were even just, let's be honest, they were fakes. And they marketed themselves as, hey, I'm a tough guy on the street. I sling rocks. And you find out the guy went to prep schools. It's just a thing.
Sure.
But Chris Wallace legitimately, you could say, had a checkered past.
Sure.
And had associations with people that would clearly be, a little bit checkered just on the street level. I'm not saying that Sean Combs, P. Diddy, Puff Daddy, whatever. I'm not saying that he was any kind of gangster. Mm-hmm. Okay. But he was definitely a hustler on a certain level. Mm-hmm. And then you introduce a character like Suge Knight into this, who I would say is a bona fide, street level tough guy. All right?
Right.
I think what happens here is the scent of all of it.
Yeah, no doubt.
But
Tupac was the biggest faker, but on purpose, and I'll tell you why.
Yeah, that's what I wanted you to address, please.
Yes. So Tupac was a intellectual prodigy as a teenager. Like when he was growing up, he said his mom used to punish him by making him read the New York Times from cover to cover. And so he ends up, now when his mom, got all this fame for defending herself in court. And then her husband, Tupac's stepfather, Mutula Shakur, is framed for this other incident, which is not worth going to in the moment, but I can later. He's being hounded by the police. He's running underground from the police after they closed up his Lincoln Detox, acupuncture clinic, and really by gunpoint. They were actually running the clinic still by free. The city defunded the clinic, and then they came at gunpoint and forced them to close down, and they actually killed the director. It's bizarre. It's actually a descendant of the President Taft was the director of the clinic. And they, they chased Mutula Shakur's underground hiding. He ends up hiding with his brother, Lumumba Shakur, his adopted brother, Lumumba Shakur. And, they capture him finally in 1984. But so she, Fanny's left, without her husband, trying to raise Tupac, trying to raise his sister, his half sister, Setua Shakur. and she's homeless, going from home to home, homeless. And into her life comes a guy named Legs Saunders, who by all evidence is connected to a CIA plant, you know, a guy named Nicky Barnes, who the New York Times called Mr. Untouchable. He was the direct assistant of Nicky Barnes, who the police could never arrest because he was tied to the CIA. And, you know, the best evidence is that his, you know, his superior, nine people in court were let off because of their connections to the CIA. That was Nicky Barnes' superior. And then below, then there's Nicky Barnes, and then right below him, his assistant is Lake Saunders. He enters Faye's life, gets her hooked on crack cocaine. Tupac is left with a crack addicted mom, and is just they're struggling. She runs to Baltimore to get help from cousins in Baltimore with Tupac. Tupac enters the Baltimore School for the Performing Arts. He's their best student by all accounts by the teachers. He's their top actor, the best actor they ever had, they told me. He's an amazing kid. And he ends up now some of his friends get killed in Baltimore. So they try to go to a better place, Oakland, to live with Geronimo Pratt's wife. He was head of the L.A. Black Panthers, and he was framed and in prison at that time. But they didn't realize that Oakland was now called Cokeland. You know, it was labeled Cokeland. So and here's he's dealing with his mother still addicted. So he ends up producing plays, reproducing Shakespeare plays in modern language, directing them and producing them locally and starring in them. So he's an amazing, you know, gifted guy, and he's reading hundreds of PhD level books before he's out of his teen years, according to Professor Michael Eric Dyson, who was shown the library he had read. And but what happened was, when he hit the big fame with the solo, you know, CD with, Tupacalypse Now, him and his, according to his business manager, Watani Tayahimba, former Black Panther, told me or confirmed to me that him and his imprisoned stepfather, Matulu Shakur, decided to take on a new plan. And that was called the Thug Life Plan, the Thug Life Movement. And that was based on the fact that, his Black Panther extended family had gotten the Bloods and the Crips to call peace truces and instead to fight activism and to turn on, you know, fight racism and turn on to activism. And so Tupac decided to help further that throughout California and then throughout the country by pretending to be a gangster in order to appeal to gangs and politicize them. So that's why he completely changed his persona, to pretend to be this gangster type in order to appeal to those gangs. And then he would appear at these gang peace truce picnics, get the leaders to shake hands and agree to what him and Matulu had devised, which was something called the Code of Thug Life, which was to get them to stop causing so much harm in their communities and get them to stop hurting each other and start, you know, doing things a little safer and a little less, you know, horrible to the Black community.
Right.
And so and that was becoming successful. It was so successful that it spread to New York City, where the biggest gang in New York was inspired by it, the Latin Kings. And they transformed with the help of the Puerto Rican activists, the Young Lords, which was the Puerto Rican version of the Black Panthers. And I talked to Young Lords about this, who mentored, King Tone, Antonio Fernandez. And I interviewed Antonio Fernandez about it all. And he confirmed it all, and they had completely given up drug dealing and gun running and stuff like that, and it stopped being murderers and stopped being drug dealers. And some New York professors wrote a book about it, you know, published on Columbia University Press, about the Almighty Latin King and Queen Nation. And so, you know, it's amazing what the movement that Tupac helped start with helped spread with his Black Panther extended family. So, for all those reasons, that's why U.S. intelligence tried to do him in early on. They tried to assassinate him when his first CD came out and kept trying and finally succeeded in Las Vegas.
Well, now, here's a question. Does the assassination attempt, where it was kind of brought out in the media as a robbery attempt when he was in a recording studio in New York?
Yeah.
Is that something that just happened because he was dealing with people that were pretty hardcore on the street level, or is that something that you think you have dug up any evidence on that would well put it in a different light other than what the mainstream spin was on it at the time?
Yeah, well, I was living in New York during part of my research on this, and so I got the trial transcripts from one of Tupac's appeals lawyers, and it's so. Basically, what the affidavit from the doctor that analyzed that, you know, Tupac and his wounds in the hospital said that one bullet was put in him that sent him to the ground. Two bullets went through the back of his skull, and those were the entrance wounds, and the exit wounds were through the front of his skull. Mm. So it's just absolutely miraculous that he survived that supposed mugging. Okay,
right.
Those bullets barely missed his brain, and it's just miraculous. And so that was a murder attempt. That was not a random mugging, because that's the way. That's a military execution. You put one bullet to get them down on the ground, and then you put two bullets in their head to make sure it's successful.
Well, military or mob, you double tap somebody to the head. I mean,
right.
It's,
no, I hear you. But so this is what happened. This was in the Quad recording studio in Times Square. Now, a random mugging in Times Square, the most well-lit place, you know, at night. This is at night, 11 p.m. at night. The most well-lit place in the world at night, okay? And that's the random mugging. They call it a random mugging. And so it's on videotape, okay? It's on security video. And the security guard got the video and gave it to, you know, offered it to the police, said, here's the video of the crime, of what happened, you know, of these guys. They turned it down and closed the case. The police turned it down and closed the case.
Huh.
So you tell me if that's not suspicious.
Oh, no, I'm not denying it. I'm just looking at it and saying, look, what would somebody think? And again, this was kind of spun into, oh, this is the East Coast, West Coast thing, which
you know, Tupac and Biggie were friends then. They were friends. And right. the other aspect of that is the fact that the first I called the New York police precinct where this officer who was the first to arrive at Tupac's body, who supervised two other cops that arrived at Tupac's body. And Tupac gave him the finger because this was the same guy that had been the first to arrive at when he was supposed, you know, with the alleged rape, which was, you know, he was found not guilty of rape. He was found guilty, not found not guilty of attempted rape, not found not guilty of assisted rape, you know, sodomy and all that. He was only found guilty of touching a woman's butt against her will that he had consensual sex with. So, you know, he gets 4.5 years in jail for that, you know. But anyway, so this guy comes there with his two assistants, you know, two fellow police officers who he's supervising. So I called his precinct and I said, I'm trying to do an article about, you know, officer whatever of the street crimes unit, and I just wanted to give the street crime unit a good you know spin because they're getting so much bad rap these days. And she says, oh, well, then officer whatever is, you know, is not due back until whenever. And so she confirmed that he was part of the street crimes unit. Okay. That was the unit that's most considered to take over for the police intelligence unit in 1971. It started in 1971 when they closed COINTELPRO. And all the best evidence is that those undercover, you know, those cops in plain clothes that now were implicated in all kinds of, you know, nasty crimes in the 1990s. Were the ones that took over the you know Bureau of Special Services, which was the police intelligence unit. So that was part of the FBI's counterintelligence program.
Right. This leads into a very serious question, which is something that I think people would find hard to believe, but I'm willing to bet you can back it up. Here's the thing. Units of police literally developed to do what? Target different things, right? This is normal. You have the drug task force. You have the, okay, you got a lot of gangs in your city. You get a gang task force together. You put together officers who might have experience, knowledge, special training, so on and so forth. Okay. We know this. This is normal. But a strange thing occurs to me in reading about some of what you wrote here. And how about this? Explain to people that there are actually units that were developed to target hip hop artists.
Yeah. Yeah. And this came out in a number of magazines. Now, what finally, you know, I show the evidence of is that there was a rap unit. There was a hip hop, you know, cop unit. Okay. To target. Now, they said to target, you know, negative rappers. They pretended like it was targeted negative rappers. But what it really was is they were targeting political rappers. And so it started in New York and Los Angeles. They had two rap units, you know, like that were targeting political rappers and expanded. You know, what they did is those two rap units were caught training, you know, police units all over the country. Miami Herald first broke this story that the Miami police were being trained by the Los Angeles and New York police departments in a, you know, convention. They were given this book that helped that, you know, train them. And the book included loads of different rappers' names. Now, what I found was the Miami Herald covered all this in great detail, but what they didn't say was they showed a timeline that before the rap unit was trained in Miami, there was just, you know, very minor stuff happening in the rap community. There was no, like, murders and things like that. After their training, the rappers were murdered. Okay, and so I show that that's just no coincidence. That's the way it happened in New York and LA also. After they started those units, these rappers end up getting shot at and killed, you know, at different points. And I name the different rappers this happened to.
Right, and here's the thing about it is that it was sold via the national media as, look, the police are naturally going to respond to the problem. Mm-hmm. And that's what the problem is here in the equation, is that it wasn't the police responding to a problem. Mm-hmm. It was an intentional targeting of, you know, somebody that they thought was going to be a problem. And that's the weird thing. It's like, oh, because there is so much violence that is provoked by these rappers. See, that's the thing. It's bad people. The gangster rap, and I've heard this now for decades and still from some older guys nowadays even, who go, oh, the culture was destroyed by the gangster rap. You know, that's the thing. The gangster rap.
Well, it depends who you lump into that. Now, Tupac was political rap. It wasn't really gangster rap, except to the extent that sometimes in some of his songs he tried to appeal to the gangs. But then again, it was to politicize them. It was to call the peace truces. It was, you know, but it was also, you know, having Malcolm X talk on his CD, his last CD, and it was dedicating his CDs to his Black Panther extended family and talking about, you know, you got to listen to them. And things like that. And so his was not gangsta as a negative rap. Now, some of the other rappers, the more negative rappers, those were the ones that got the most promotion. And the ones like, you know, Public Enemy and Tupac and all, well, you know, Public Enemy in particular didn't get the promotion that the negative rappers got, the one that truly just glorified drugs and murders and things like that.
No, see, Public Enemy's message, which, you know, I was observing as it emerged in that area of the country, right, was more about, you know, think for yourself, open up to the fact that the system is loaded against you. And that's the way it is.
Right.
And even you go back to Rakim and some of that other stuff that people would think of as, you know, very antiquated. You go back to the message even and all this stuff.
Different productions and stuff, yeah. They were positive.
It was a positive thing. It was about, look, there are some rough situations here, but you don't have to accept this.
Right.
And you don't have to accept the mentality that's being handed to you. And, you know, and prey upon each other. And that was actually the message.
Yeah.
And it's like I could never understand how to. I mean, look, and I'm well aware that stuff like, you know, when NWA came out and, you know, did their whole thing and Eazy-E with his attitude and all that. I get how that frightened some people in suburbia. I really do.
But yeah, even NWA, you got to remember that Dr. Dre and what's his name? Ice Cube. has actually they were just describing the community, and they were still giving some positive messages while describing even the most negative parts of the community. I mean, Eazy got a little more negative than them in the fact that he had been a serious drug dealer, no doubt.
Right.
But they still overall had a more positive message, and especially Dre, when Dre actually rapped against smoking weed because he says it doesn't help your rapping, it makes you stupider. That's what he basically said, in one of his songs about that. And so, and then Death Row Records comes in, pulls Dr. Dre out of there, takes pulls another rapper out of there who was helping produce them, and disrupts them, and threatens Eazy-E. And Eazy-E gets, AIDS and whatever, but Dre, basically Death Row, that Suge Knight and Death Row Records, that was their purpose. Their purpose was to disrupt the more positive political rap community. And they were founded by a man, they were founded really by the lawyer for Death Row Records, Dave Kenner, who was a gangster. He was basically mafia. He was Jewish mafia. And he had formerly represented. He started Death Row Records with a guy named Michael Harry O. Harris, who was one of the top two assistants of Freeway Ricky Ross, according to Gary Webb. And Freeway Ricky Ross was getting all his cocaine from CIA associates, a part of the Nicaraguan Contra Army, which was, basically Gary Webb called it the CIA's army, secret army.
Oh, yeah. No, if you look back in my archives, I got an interview with Freeway Ricky Ross where we talk about Blendone and all these guys.
Yeah, exactly
how he ended up with, so much cocaine he couldn't sell it fast enough.
Yeah.
The only way to get that kind of flow of that kind of snow is with a little bit of help. That's the reality of it. I'm not saying that Freeway Ricky Ross ought to be glorified. I'm just saying that he was pretty honest about it. And, when he was on my show anyway, talking about it afterwards, and it was like, look, man, this came down. It was a way to make the money, and it was available right away. And he found out kind of accidentally what was really going on. I actually paired him up with Celly Castillo on my show to make the point. So
that's great. That's a great show.
And it's just, look, there is a whole world of what was weaponized against not just the black community, but the poor communities of the country. Right. And again, I think it was justified in the mainstream media sense by this idea that, look, these people want to, almost like the old quote from The Godfather, let them sell it in their neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Let them destroy themselves. It was okay. You brought up Nicky Barnes, and there's heroin, so different trade slightly.
Yeah.
But fact is, cheap dope coming in, it was not going to happen without the government's wink and a nod. And
more than a wink and a nod, more it was actually assisting it coming in. All my clients told me in the early 90s, they got the planes, they got the boats. We don't have that stuff, so we know who's really bringing in the government. Governments can, has the cargo ships that were caught, according to 60 Minutes, were caught with tons of cocaine, it's just – that's the way it happens.
But see, it was acceptable to the general American public for a long time. I mean, I can tell you that I've got a personal history. My personal history, let me tell you something. I knew how to cut up and redistribute dope by the time I was 10, 11 years old, right? And it's because that's what was available to me in New Jersey, of all places. But it was coming in such massive amounts that, late 70s, early 80s, you're talking about a lot of heroin. Nobody even discusses it because cocaine, soon after would overshadow it, and the crack epidemic, as they put it, would suddenly strike.
The crack epidemic got more press, but in Baltimore, I remember our statistics, the crack cocaine ended up equaling heroin, but never really surpassed heroin. They were kind of neck and neck for a long time. So it depends on the city for which one really, they generally were hand in hand, neck and neck in a lot of cities. But some cities, of course, crack did get more fame than heroin in a lot of cities too.
Oh, yeah. And in the one section of Harlem, which I used to have to travel to, right, a lot, you know, one section was very much devoted to smack, and the other section, well, you know, ended up being devoted to crack. It was just that simple. It was a division of South and North Harlem. And I got to tell you, it was open. It was an open secret. I never understand the following thing, though, which is that, you know, the heroin didn't get the press, like you said. But there it was. It had been coming in, you know, like snow again. Okay, to the Northeast, and believe me, snow is a problem in the Northeast. It was coming into the Northeast like snow, and it was doing it for, well, you know, 10, 15 years before I got there that I know of for sure. And, you know, again, I was born in 72. So by the time, you know, 1982 comes around and 10-year-old me is able to figure out how to repackage the dope, okay? And look, I learned how to cook stuff on a stovetop too. But cocaine was not as accessible even in my world. But it was already established. There was no big headlines, it seemed like to me. It was a known fact. I mean, there were places that they used to call them shooting galleries. In a lot of places in New York and New Jersey. And what it basically was abandoned buildings where junkies were shooting up. They could buy it. They could shoot it up. And they were just crashed out in, like, nightmarish places. It was a real thing.
Right. And this is why I say my two books overlap, The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Drugs as Weapons Against Us, because in Drugs as Weapons Against Us, I just document how that heroin that you dealt with was most likely coming from the area of Afghanistan, you know, where the CIA had set up their, you know, their little secret army to, you know, with Pakistan and Gulbadan Hekmatyar. Was running things, was forming what, you know, they called the Golden Crescent for heroin, starting in like the mid to late 1970s, because they needed that Golden Crescent to take over for the Golden Triangle that they kind of lost after they lost the Vietnam War, where they lost a lot of the areas where they were, you know, getting all that best heroin from Vietnam. They're now getting it from the Afghanistan area, and of course that goes on until today. We wanted to control that area because those are the two best areas in the world for growing poppy fields and producing the heroin. And so, you know, the opiates and the heroin. So they, you either got your heroin and you also got your painkillers from those areas.
Well, but that's the thing, though. The American public doesn't take, you know, notice of this effectively en masse until what? 20 years after I'm done doing what I was doing. And it's amazing to me. It's like, wait, this never went anywhere. This has been here all along. This is not new. Oh, wait a minute. You know, not only did they repackage and re-legalize it again, because if you go through the corporate version of drug dealing, that's also fun. I mean, you can go all the way back to when they were giving it to women for menstrual cramps. Okay. opium has been continuously repackaged, remastered, and handed out again. And it hasn't stopped, but now it's an epidemic because, you know, it's not just among those people that it's okay, because they live in the cities and they live in places that we don't want to visit without rolling up our windows and being nervous. So, you know, I always found that interesting. But, you know, we're going to go back to this Tupac thing because there's still more to tell, isn't there? You know, we didn't get past that one assassination attempt. And then there was various things that went on that were strange cases. You talked about appeals. I remember a circumstance where maybe he pulled a gun, maybe he didn't pull a gun. There were all kinds of different things going on where it seemed like, well, again, and as I noted, you know, earlier in the show, way earlier in the show, there were various times where different musicians, different artists were definitely targeted. I mean, I don't think they caught Ray Charles by accident. I don't think they caught, you know, Chuck Berry by accident. But
yeah,
they were more of social nuisances. And local police departments wanted to get them because rock and roll is evil and because, you know, they're riling up the kids. And I think there was some element of that with Tupac. But that is clearly not what happened. And the fact that you got still and ready, air quotes, unsolved murder. Okay, you have all of this stuff having gone on. You have a clear target being painted on his back by more than one organization capable of killing him. Mm-hmm. Okay, the idea that, yeah, he did indeed mingle with, well, let's be honest, some criminal elements, whether you're talking about Suge Knight or you're talking about the people that he's trying to convert out of gangbanging.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean, yeah. There's a lot of danger here.
You're right. So it was an interesting course that he went through, because he starts with this. His most political album was his first album, Tupacalypse Now. He said F-U-C-K to the CIA, F-U-C-K to the FBI and the Bushes and all that. And he says that on one of his songs, you know, and on the album. And it's a very political album, you know, Tupacalypse Now. But, you know, then his second album was just as political. But it started getting, you know, his third album then got less political. His fourth album with Death Row was the least political, actually. And so it was in a strange, you know, that's like a backwards way. Most people get more political as they get older and more mature. But he actually, you know, people close to him forced him, you know, forced his songs to be diluted, basically, is what happened. But nonetheless, so Tupac starts with this really political album. And, you know, Words of Wisdom was extremely political with the lines I just told you. And then at that time, police supposedly stop him for jaywalking. They choke him unconscious and bang his head against the curb. And I show two instances where people died in police custody that way. And then you go into another incident where he's invited as an honorary guest at a festival, a music festival in Rinfest. In their 25th anniversary, I think it was, and police watch as strangers punch him for no reason, then shoot at him, and nearly beat him to death. But he crawls under a police car to save himself, and you know, basically they use a psychological technique to rile up a crowd to try to get other people involved who didn't know what they were doing, like what was going on exactly. Then there's a situation in Atlanta. Where he's done he finishes a concert. He's coming with his group of cars, you know, away from the concert, and two supposedly off-duty police officers, the Whitwell brothers, are out and beating on a black man right in front of Tupac's car when he's at a light, at a red light. He rolls down. All eyewitnesses, white and black, who I've gotten, you know, quotes from, say they saw. Basically, he rolled down his window and said, "What's going on?" They then run to his car, smash his window with the butt of a gun, and shoot at him. Okay, shoot at Tupac. Now, the gun, turns out, was stolen from an evidence locker. And that's what's called a throwaway gun, in case you make an illegal, you know, shooting and you have to put it down and it can't be traced back to you.
Right.
So Tupac merely rolls out the back of his car, grabs a security guard's gun, and shoots back in self-defense. And he shoots them in the butt and the legs, and it doesn't even go through trial. You know, here's a black man shooting two white police officers in Atlanta, and doesn't even go through the full trial. And obviously, they stopped it because it was an unsuccessful assassination attempt number two or three, at least. Okay, and that's the way these things went.
And well, this transition is even weirder than what you're talking about, because honestly, there's a point in his career as a musician where he's like appearing with the digital underground. Absolutely no poetry. You know, nothing is radically being shown in public by this guy, but he was trying to make his way in the industry.
Right.
So there's that
backup dancer for him, and just add some lyrics, like one song in there. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, but again, this is the kind of knockaround jobs you get just, you know, making your way in the industry. And right. The guy obviously had multiple talents in order to, you know, be part of the production crew. I mean, look, that was fairly sophisticated for its time.
Yeah, he was only 18 years old when he was part, you know, when they asked him to tour with him. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not disparaging it. You understand? I'm trying to say that this is a very dynamic individual who right. made some weird choices, it seems, because, as you said, usually people get more political because they're more established. They can handle it, whatever. Comes right out and does make a lot of political statements initially, becomes a prominent figure on more than one level, and then kind of backs down a little bit. And meanwhile, behind the scenes, it seems like. Maybe I'm reading this wrong.
You're posing good questions, and I'll tell you why in a moment when you're done. Sure.
Yeah, it's just like I'm watching this ride here that seems like there's a strategy, and I don't know all of the particulars here because it seems like he was at certain points trying to use his public persona to cover for what he was doing. And then in other cases, he was trying to leverage his public persona to assist with what he was trying to do. Meanwhile, like you said, continuously reading, continuously writing. There's tons and tons of stuff that has been published, you know, after his death. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I mean, there really is. There's a lot of writing that he did. I'm not saying I'm a fan of all of it, but some of it is extremely profound. Deep philosophical thoughts, but through the lens of a very streetwise linguistic code, let's say.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Right.
And I appreciate it, but I'm a little confused by this guy. Help me.
So around the time of his first album was when he decided on that thug life plan to pretend to be this gangster, to appeal to gangs and politicize them. So he tried to not – like he had a song when he was about 17 years old called Panther Power that was just explicitly can't deal with this capitalistic society. It was made to attack you and me, drugs and sneak attacks on our community. They kill our unity and, you know, things like that where he was like more explicit about his politics.
Right.
Then he decided to say, okay, you can't talk about capitalism and stuff like that. That's, you know, people aren't going to know what he's really talking about. He decided to go, you know, more to the street level and use more simple language and pretend, and then also hide it in this pretend to be gangsta style. So Words of Wisdom was a little more political and straightforward, but by his next album, Strictly for My NIGGAZ, that's when he was taking on the gangster persona. And right. He had some really political lines, you know, about the cops are gangs and the media are just as dirty, you know, and the courts are dirty. And it's really interesting how he does have a lot of profound insights in things like, you know, in different songs such as Holler If You Hear Me, such as, you know, Strictly For My Niggas and things like that. But he then, his third album, what happened was between his first and second album, first album was produced by Interscope, and Time Warner didn't like that it went gold. So they bought out 51% of Interscope, and they had a controlling interest of Interscope. So when he tried to put his get more political even on Strictly For My NIGGAZ, they delayed his album for a year. They wouldn't put it out for a year. And he had all these anti-Bush and anti-Quayle messages on that album. And right. They delayed it till after the election. They wouldn't let it come out before the election like it was supposed to. And wow. Then they watered it down. They wouldn't allow the more political songs. They watered it down. They'd only allow the less political songs. And then they continued to do that, to not allow political songs on his third album.
Yeah, well, this is the point at which it's like the music becomes a lot more focused and centered on the hooks and stuff like that, yeah. Which frankly made him a little more popular as far as a crossover artist. You know, it seemed like it kind of backfired on the record company where they were like, yeah, you're not going to sit here and go into these tirades, but, you know, we'll put some more hooks on this. And yeah. It actually worked, which was weird. But at the same time, throughout all this, he still has these insights, mm-hmm. which are, you know, sort of hidden almost in some of this stuff. It's almost like he tried to bury it, or maybe it was the producers tried to bury it. I'm not sure which. But either way, it's a weird trajectory. So, but continue on.
Yeah, I hear you. So, well, what happened was then his third album comes out while he's in prison. And it hits number one, and so he's in the what's that New York City prison? I just totally forgot the name of it all of a sudden. But well,
he was at Rikers, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was at Rikers. Right, thanks. He was at Rikers, and all the police, I mean, all the press is interviewing him because his record's number one while he's in prison. You know, it stays number one for several weeks at least. And they interview him while he's in prison, and he talks about, you know, what are we doing going and bombing, the Serbian area and all, you know, Yugoslavia and all, you know, it's like we're acting like gangs and going and bombing other countries this way. And right. So what they do, they moved him to Clinton Correctional Institute, 10 hours north of New York City. And they put him so it's the most maximum security prison in New York. It's a maximum security prison. And then they put him in solitary confinement for 10 of his 11 months in prison. And they used what they called penal coercion tactics, which were, according to Amnesty International, the closest thing we had to brainwashing. Now, I document there's actually closer things to brainwashing, you know, with hypnosis and drugs as weapons against us with MKUltra. But nonetheless, the penal coercion tactics they use against activists were used against Tupac. They actually tortured him in prison, you know, in more ways than just the penal coercion.
And solitary confinement in and of itself is recognized internationally as torturous anyway. You know, and the reasons by which they isolated them and everything else, this is not only how, like you said, how they do break individuals that are career criminals in certain places, you know, in the high security units, there's certain prisons that are, you know, supermaxes and things where they do this, but they also in other countries for sure. And guess what? America too, break political dissidents. This is how you break somebody.
Yeah,
and they did more than that. Go ahead.
Yeah, they said they took the, you know, they put on gloves and pretended to do rectal searches for contraband, even though when anyone visited him. So, that's another way they tortured him. And so every time they visit him, even though they watched the whole visit, they knew he couldn't have, you know, hidden anything anywhere or gotten anything because they were watched the whole time. They still would do that with their gloved fingers, you know. And so this is the horrible shit they did to him while he was in prison. And it really messed up his mind. And Death Row Records continued this kind of behavior of threatening him, you know, inadvertent, you know, just killing, you know, shooting people or torturing people and beating up people in front of him, doing all kinds of crazy crap like that to threaten him and mess his head up. They fed him constant weed and alcohol, like right when he was out of jail, and put him in the studio and influenced him to produce the most negative lyrics he ever produced for his top double album for Death Row Records, which was the most negative one. And he ended up producing a lot of those songs, you know, like pushing the whole, you know, Bad Boy versus Death Row Records crap, East versus West crap. And, you know, and pretending like, you know, he's out for Biggie because he was, you know, people had sent him fake letters in jail, just like they did with his Black Panther mother, Fannie Shakur. They sent fake letters back and forth between Fannie Shakur and her fellow Black Panthers in New York to Huey Newton and the Oakland Black Panthers, sent them back and forth and pretended like there's a huge feud between them. That was the East Coast versus West Coast Black Panther feud back then. And it mirrors what they did with the, you know, Tupac and Biggie in when Tupac was in jail, and they had, you know, they paid people in jail to say, oh, you don't know who shot you. You know, everyone knows Biggie was the one that set up that shooting of you. And so that's what turned him against his friend Biggie Smalls. And, you know, even though Biggie had visited him while he was in the hospital after that shooting, he didn't, right. You know, he didn't know what to think about all that. His head's getting so messed up from the torture and the solitary confinement and all these people telling him these things. And so that's what, you know, that's what caused that negativity in his that album with Death Row Records. But then in his last album, he got more political. He got more positive. He said he was going to start doing more things. You know, he actually wrote a song about how Haitian Jack, which is his real name was Jacques Ignan, was working for the feds because his lawyer, Michael Treif Warren, told me that he got Jacques Ignan's rap sheet. And he had a long list of serious cases up and down the East Coast all dismissed. And he said that's the sure sign of a police intelligence agent. And so that's why he, you know, said all that. He said, you know, Haitian Jack set me up and wet me up, set me up, meaning, you know, set me up with the situation with the, you know, accusation of rape when it was really, you know, consensual sex, the jury found, but he just touched her butt, you know, afterwards. And they said touched her butt against her will. And for that, they didn't realize the judge would give him 4.5 years in jail for just touching a woman's butt again, you know, after consensual sex. Right. And so, So he found not guilty of all other charges, a whole list of charges besides that. Anyway, so set me up and then wet me up, and wet me up is, of course, slang for shooting me, having me shot, because he knew that an associate of Haitian Jack's was the one that set up the situation in the New York recording studio lobby. And that was this guy who lured him to the studio by saying, I'm going to give you some like $10,000 cash just for this one song, just to rap a few lines, actually to rap a few lines on another person's, album. And so he knew what was going on. And he said they're both working for the feds. Set me up, wet me up. You know, knew you were working for the feds. And of course, that's Federal Bureau of Investigation. So he laid it all out in that album. And it's incredible that that album even got out to the public, because he helped it get out and they didn't realize what it was all about. And but he got out to the public, and of course, but he was assassinated or murdered, before you could see it come out.
Right. And then, of course, there's been a lot of speculation since his death, about what actually happened. And look, I enjoy some of the conspiracy world. I really do. And some of it is very legitimately based, and some of it is just, legend building.
Right.
And I admit that there is a bit of both things that I'm engaged in as far as, examining it. Mm-hmm. On this show, I try to avoid the legend building except to mention it as something that exists, but people have speculated, he wasn't dead. There's a whole, a whole lot of controversies related to his autopsy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there is just a continuous pile of really interesting rabbit holes,
yeah,
been put out there, and I feel as though, now maybe I'm wrong, again, I defer to your judgment.
Sure.
I would say that all of this has been done on purpose to continue two things. One, the profitability that still existed, especially with a guy who's dead, who clearly had a meteoric rise as far as the American public was concerned. You can always monetize and remonetize that. So I think that's one motivation. But also, I think it is meant to keep us away from how it is you end up with an unsolved murder of somebody with a whole bunch of witnesses, and a whole bunch of things going on here. A lot of diversions. Who's who? Some people say maybe Suge Knight was the target and, so on and so forth. I got to tell you, I feel like this has all been done on purpose, as it has been done in other assassinations, whether they be for political means or other. Quite frankly, when somebody's dangerous and the powers that should not be decide they need to be disposed of, it's convenient to leave 100 open threads. And I think that's what's been done here. What are your thoughts on that, post-mortem? Is that something that's been purposefully propagandized for people to just remain confused and default to, well, listen, thug life, that's what you get. Oh, okay, he was a gangsta, that's what you get. He was hanging around gangsters, that's what you get. Mm-hmm. You think that is the key, or is it really just to keep us off balance as to what really happened here?
Yeah, well, Russell Poole was an investigator that accidentally, he was a high-level police, Los Angeles police detective, who accidentally witnessed another situation with a undercover police officer, called moonlighting police officer in Death Row Records. And he witnessed something happen with that and ended up being asked to be part of the investigation of Biggie Smalls' murder, and then found what he found, which is, he said they found dozens of his fellow police officers at all levels of Death Row Records. And he asked his superiors, what are they doing there? And the superiors told him, you can call them troubleshooters or covert agents. Okay. That's the direct quote. And so that was, that was published in the book Labyrinth by Randall Sullivan, who's a veteran reporter, published in Rolling Stone, Vanity Fair, et cetera, And so anyway, so you got that book Labyrinth documenting all of Russell Poole's notes and files and everything. And so three different, movie studios tried to make a a movie out of that book Labyrinth with Russell Poole, with top stars playing Russell Poole. First, Sylvester Stallone was supposed to play Russell Poole. And then Leonardo DiCaprio was supposed to play Russell Poole for a DreamWorks production. And then Johnny Depp was played Russell Poole. And the first two films were announced. They were all in production, everything else. And then they got squashed by the Los Angeles Police Department. How does the Los Angeles Police Department have that much power to squash a major motion picture that's supposed to come out throughout the country? Well, they're very powerful. That's why, because they're connected to U.S. intelligence. And so finally, Johnny Depp's film got squashed when it was already done. The previews were already out. I saw the previews in two different movie chains. And it got squashed for years, and it finally came out in a very limited release. But I saw it in the movie theater just maybe a year ago. Nonetheless, the importance of this is that Russell Poole, even though he was murdered before he could come out with more and more information, Russell Poole did come out with a good amount of information. And what he came out with is the fact that he said that he believes, and he said this in for the film Biggie and Tupac, you know, which was – put out by award-winning British filmmaker Nick Broomfield, and he also said it for the, you know, a little bit of stuff for the book Labyrinth. But he basically said that he thinks that his fellow police officers murdered Biggie Smalls in order to hide their murder of Tupac and make it look like an East Coast versus West Coast rivalry as the reason that these people died, instead of the fact that, you know, that they really just wanted to hide their murder of Tupac. Now, he didn't know why his fellow cops murdered Tupac, but this is what he had found. And so now he didn't understand the full political history of Tupac for that. And he did say his friends, he said, told him not to send his work, his files to the FBI because you can't trust them. But he did it anyway, and nothing came of it. And so, you know, that's basically the way it all went down. But what Death Row Records was doing was Death Row Records was trafficking drugs, trafficking guns, and trying to end the Bloods versus Crips peace truce movement, the exact opposite of what Tupac was doing, which was to extend the Blood Crips peace truce movement. Right. And so Tupac, now Suge Knight was low man on the totem pole, and he just, you know, helped set things up without knowing the full extent of all that was going on. Reggie Wright Jr. was the head of the security for Death Row Records. He was a supposedly former Los Angeles police cop, but he was actually still obviously working undercover because his father was head of the Compton Gang's police unit. And Compton was one of the first places where the gang peace truce movement started. And so this is the way a lot of it worked. Now, Chuck D. loved Tupac, and of course he wanted to see him live on, and so he theorized that he escaped and did live on, and I don't blame Chuck D for wishing that. We all would have loved Tupac to live on, but right. The best evidence is that he didn't. Nonetheless, you know, a lot of theories came out that maybe he did escape to Cuba, but there's just no evidence to support that. I wish he did, because his aunt Assad Shakur, a former, you know, leading Bronx Black Panther, escaped to Cuba with the help of Tupac's Black, you know, Panther extended family. But they sprung her out of jail and got her to Cuba. But, right. Yeah.
And that's limited series that documents this thing with Poole, where he's trying to turn it over. First, he thinks he can maybe trust the guys in Vegas, and he can't trust them. They don't want to hear it. He tries to bring it to the FBI. They don't want to hear it. He goes above people's heads. He gets transferred. I mean, loses his job. They marginalize the guy. They you know, steal his evidence at certain points. They do all kinds of stuff to this guy.
So, yeah, that was a pretty good series, because it's basically all of us activist researchers that pushed them to finally show Russell Poole in a little better light. The problem with that theory, that series, it was, I think it was called Unsolved, was that they present Gray Kading in a positive light. And Gray Kading was Russell Poole said Kading is a police disinformation agent. I mean, he basically said he's a corrupt cop they brought back out of retirement. He was forced into retirement because he was caught lying in court so blatantly, Kading. And so they brought him out of retirement, and the best evidence is that he was hired after the fact to reopen the investigation, you know, of Tupac's assassination, or really murder, you know, but they call it the murder, and pretend like Biggie Smalls and Puffy paid some Crips to kill Tupac, It's, and you know, basically the best documentary series on this whole situation is Who Killed Tupac by A&E. And I was in that series, and Tupac's brother, Mopreme Shakur, was a producer of that series. And there's a lot of excellent, you know, segments of that. And basically it ends with Reverend Al Sharpton saying, when you say the kind of things Tupac said against the government, you just, you know, you can end up dead. And that's the way he concluded, when after analyzing all the evidence. And some of the evidence analyzes, they interviewed Greg Kading, and they got him to admit that they gave this guy, you know, Keefe D, a huge break on a, you know, coming trial, a massive trial that would have had him in prison for decades. Right. And they gave him a huge break in order for him to say what they wanted him to say. That's what happened. And they said that's such a ridiculous testimony to go by, that to say that that's truthful, that it's, you know, it just totally disqualifies Kading and his witness, his best witness that supports his whole ridiculous theory. So, yeah.
No, I appreciate that. It's just, I just wanted to say that a lot of the facts do get out in that series. It's just that, like you said, as per usual, you know, something's always twisted in the mix. Right. So, you know, it's almost impossible to get at the whole of, you know, because really this is more than one story. You know, the murder of the man is one thing. The cover up afterwards is yet another thing. You know, and then the biggest question always is why, you know, yeah. And that is, it's easy to answer and yet hard to answer, because, you know, one wants to believe that in the world, maybe, you know, they can tolerate an artist who says something, you know, regardless of whether it puts the government in a positive or negative light. You would think we live in a world where that is the case, but over and over again, guess what we're shown? It isn't. So, I want to wind this up by pretty much saying, look, there's two versions of this book out there, right? And
the version I took off, you know, because the second version came out, I took it off market. So the second version is the only version available right now.
Well, yeah, but, you know, some people might find it in a used book thing or whatever.
Yeah, they might, sure.
Yeah, I want to be really clear about this new version, because sounds to me like you put in some more work, even though, look, how much more work are you going to put in? You've been doing this, writing about this since the mid-90s. Sure. You know, but where is it available? What, you know, do you want people to take away from tonight's discussion? And remind us of the full title one more time, because, you know, I tripped over it a little bit. I want you to read it out, if you don't mind.
Sure, yeah. So it's titled The FBI War on Tupac Shakur, State Repression of Black Leaders from the Civil Rights Era to the 1990s. And it's available on a lot of Barnes & Noble shelves. And if it's not on their shelves, they can get it in their store in 2 to 3 days. It's also available on Amazon, of course, and it's available in a number of independent bookstores. But or you could buy it directly from me, and I can autograph it for you if you ask for that at FBIWarOnTupac.com, or you can also, it's also titled, my website's also titled JohnPotash.com, or Potash is easier to say, so JohnPotash.com. And so, you know, FBIWarOnTupac.com or JohnPotash.com, and of course at that website you can also see that trailer for my that film, Shots, Eugenics, the Pandemics. But I appreciate your allowing me to hash it all out, Chuck, and in your expansive knowledge on the subject too, you know, of all, a lot of different aspects of it too. It's fun talking to you about it all.
Well, I certainly don't feel like I have the most expansive knowledge on it, but I do have an awareness of it. And I think anybody that's interested could find your work interesting on a lot of different levels, whether you think you know a lot about this or not, because I'm learning just listening to you right now. I'm sure there's more in the book, and I want to encourage people again to go to FBIWarOnTupac.com. So that's all one word till you get to the two, to the .com. FBIWarOnTupac.com. Go there. Of course, go to JohnPotash.com anytime. Cause the, you know, his work on the drug war period is, amazing. Okay. But this is a particular area that I want to focus on. So now I can talk to you about your work on the drug war in general. I could do 100 shows with you, man. We can talk about it all day. Fine. But this is of special interest to me because I think it is, again, another example where one way or another, okay, either even if you don't necessarily find that the powers that be were directly involved in the murder, here's what I don't think anyone can dispute, and that is they didn't want this solved at all, okay? And if they don't want it solved, got to be a reason for it. Now, that leads to some logical questions that John Potash, not sure how to pronounce it properly, Potash. But either way.
I like Potash. It's easiest. It's best.
Potash, and that's the way it looks, actually, P-O-T-A-S-H. So John Potash will answer them in this book if you have questions about it. So I appreciate your work. I know, and again, I haven't read this thing cover to cover. I've read some excerpts. And just with, you know, some of my other knowledge about, well, the general climate, what was going on, and the subjects involved here, this is something that should be of interest. I had a couple people go, well, why do I want to hear about Tupac? Well, why do you want to hear about anybody? I mean, some people out there want to still hear about why maybe John Lennon was gotten rid of, right? Yeah. That was 1980.
Yeah, that's in my Drugs as Weapons Against This book and film, sure.
Oh, yeah, and belongs in that book, okay? And there's a lot to it. You and I could talk about Jimi Hendrix. We could talk about the crack epidemic in general, the real crack epidemic. We could talk about, you know, the government collusion with drug dealers. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe it's not collusion if, you know, they're your employees. But anyway, you know, just saying. And that goes way further than cocaine, heroin, you know, and all those things they tell you to be afraid of. I mean, we could get into psychedelics and all that at some point. You and I discussed that a little bit before.
Right. Yeah, we could definitely discuss that more. There's so much to that. I can't even, it's endless with the psychedelics.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, and it goes way beyond MK Ultra, too, which is something else that needs to come up in this discussion. Although, believe me, I'm not saying that Tupac has anything to do with MK Ultra, to my knowledge. But I'm just saying that.
A little bit.
Okay.
Just in the sense that they were, you know, when they got him promoting weed, that's, you know, and he was fighting to stop promoting weed, and he finally got sober before he died. That's, I think that has something to do with it. Not that weed's so bad, but I think not only are they putting crap in the weed that's really messing, you know, but they're also, getting that spice in there and stuff like that. And some people are losing their minds from some crap in the weed or the spice, whatever it is. I've seen that in my counseling. It's terrible.
Yeah, and the other thing to keep in mind here is that, again, even if you want to take a look at the psychological control techniques, the way that prisoners are handled, and I know, again, this is one of those topics some people go, so I don't care, they're prisoners. But you got to understand something. When it comes to the manipulation of individuals, the torture of individuals, we're all eligible for this so long as we keep a blind eye to it. And yeah. It was only briefly touched on in this interview, but there is a lot to be said about the way, guess what, people are treated in prison.
Yeah.
And look, again, there are some people I know that would say, I don't care. These are bad people. But not everybody in prison is necessarily guilty, number one. And number two, sometimes they're placed in there just so they can get run through the techniques and even the run-of-the-mill stuff that's done.
Right.
You know, county jails aren't all that, you know, complex. Yeah. But when you go into the prison system, one way or another, it is a whole new level of breaking an individual. And that is also included in the story that that John tells in this book. So once again, FBI War on Tupac.com, the author, John Potash. And I am always pleased to have you on. We're going to have to revisit this. And when that film comes out, okay, Eugenics to Pandemics, okay?
Shots, Eugenics to Pandemics, yep.
Yeah, we're going to need to discuss that because, again, I think that's another undercovered story. People want to forget the eugenics history that is, oh, guess what, American. my argument is even that the whole Nazi thing wouldn't have happened without American inspiration. But
yes, I get into that in the film, sure.
Not everybody likes to hear that, John, but we'll do it anyway. What do you say?
That'd be great, Chuck. Look forward to it.
Excellent. So once again, FBI War on Tupac.com. John Potash, excuse me again. Either way, Potash, if you don't know his work, you need to know it. Get to it. Anyway, the Ocelli Effect is done. I want to thank John for being on here, Nature Boy for booking it, and we will revisit these topics, I assure you. We might even do another show on Tupac. We'll see what you guys learn. And if you have any extensive questions, I'll ask John to come back on. How about that? Anyway, all done. I am Merely Ocelli. All of you are the effect. Good night.